Hey, this is just a quick note about our sponsor, Privado, the premier enterprise privacy platform, purpose-built to bridge the gap between privacy and engineering. Its privacy code scanning solution embeds privacy, compliance, and governance into the product development lifecycle and empowers privacy and security teams with unparalleled visibility of sensitive data flows and the insights to find and fix privacy vulnerabilities. You can leverage Privado's data flows, dynamic data mapping, privacy assessment automation, and real-time visibility of privacy issues. Enter the era of proactive privacy and transform privacy from business blocker to business enabler. To learn more, go to privado.ai.
This means that it's not just doing a PIA with a software engineer and communicating policy requirements like delete data according to policy, but actually understand technical limitations, capabilities, and maybe opportunities. You know, when you see common patterns of issues across different products, you should be able to recommend different technical solutions that will be more efficient for different teams. How do you gather those skills? Maybe join engineering discussions as a privacy SME and learn more about these software components, or you build software yourself to understand how these systems work in harmony.
Welcome everyone to Shifting Privacy Left. I'm your host and resident privacy guru, Deborah J. Farber. Today, I'm delighted to welcome my next two guests, Engin Boda, Senior Staff Privacy Architect at Uber. He's based in Austin, Texas. And Stefano Bonatti, Privacy Engineer at HERE Technologies, that's H-E-R-E, which is based in Zurich, Switzerland. Engin is Uber's Principal Privacy Architect and the team lead of Uber's Privacy Architecture team. He holds a PhD in AI ethics and authored one of the first works of algorithmic bias. He also helped create ISO 31700, the world's first standard on privacy by design, which I contributed to as well here from the United States. Engin has gained extensive experience in diverse organizational settings, cultivating a privacy-focused career that has evolved over the course of a decade. Throughout his journey, he has assumed multifaceted roles, encompassing legal expertise, privacy engineering, engineering management, research, and consultancy in the realm of privacy. Stefano is a privacy engineer at HERE Technologies. He holds a PhD in privacy algorithms. And at HERE, Stefano worked on the technology behind Anonymizer, HERE's first privacy-focused product, and authored a number of patents and scientific publications. So today we're going to be talking about location data and anonymization, what it means to be a privacy architect, new privacy architectures, and how to get privacy issues fixed within scaling companies. So this is my very first time welcoming two guests on the show at the same time. And, I'm really excited to dive in. So let's see how this goes. Welcome, Engin and Stefano.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you for the invite. Great to be here.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Great. Okay. So I originally reached out to you both because I saw that you were presenting the talk, Can Location Data Truly Be Anonymized? A Risk-Based Approach to Location Data Anonymization at the 2023 International Workshop on Privacy Engineering. And I wanted to dig deeper on that topic. I think my audience has a lot of thirst for that. Let's get started. What are some of the technical and business challenges in obtaining anonymization? Engin, first, that's to you.
Yeah, I think before we even think about different anonymization techniques, we have to understand the business use case. What does the use case need in terms of data and which technique can we use to reduce the risk? So we can't just start with anonymization as an end goal. We need to understand the purpose. So, if I can give an example, imagine you have an app where the user might buy t-shirts. They might click in the app. They might type keywords like the size, design, or specific images belonging to different searches. So usage data and anonymizing of such usage data is very different than anonymization of location data, because re-identification risk for individuals will be much higher. And I mean, think about medical images, brings a totally different complexity. Going back to the location data, this is what our talk focused on. We looked into several features of location data that impacts anonymity. So, you know, you can think about aggregation, the data belonging to a single user, or is it aggregated among a larger crowd, or how long the data is collected as a unit? Do we need the entire trips for location, or do we need a subset of trips? How frequent is the data? Do we collect it every second, every month? And how precise and accurate is it? You know, in an ideal world, you would reduce all these features and arrive at anonymous data, but there will be very different use cases. You know, think about finding the best charging station for an EV, or you ask your AI assistant to give you some recommendations on trips based on your habits, or fraud detection. So you cannot reduce all those features. So that's kind of the challenge. And this is, again, I noticed in some threat modeling frameworks that wants full anonymity, but it might or might not be possible on the depending on the use case. And you also need to think about additional controls on top of anonymization.
Thanks. That is a lot of good framing of the issue. So Stefano, you know, what are your thoughts on some of the technical and business challenges obtaining anonymization?
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. So let me start with the business challenge. I'm striking a balance between different ways of anonymizing data and the value that anonymized data brings to the product development. For me, the best trade-off is when the data retains enough information to produce a high-quality product, while simultaneously it does not retain enough information to compromise the privacy of data subjects. By data subjects, I mean those individuals responsible for generating the data. Each product has a specific requirement or specific requirements on data quality and system design, which directly impact what trade-offs are desirable. For example, I receive sometimes questions regarding collecting disaggregated personal data to compute statistics, which could as well be computed from aggregated data. The reason being that disaggregated data might become useful in future products. When the business reason is so uncertain and also the requirements are not yet defined, it is hard to justify the privacy cost. So in these situations, I follow the principle of data minimization. Another interesting example is sharing the location of a vehicle that is involved in a traffic accident. In this instance, the benefits of providing assistance to individuals involved in the accident and ensuring the safety of other drivers can indeed outweigh the privacy concerns. Under these circumstances, a product will be developed based on the vital interest legal basis. I invite you all to check out our presentation, which we gave in our latest talk. You will find an overview of common use cases around location data and their requirements. Now, for the technical challenge, it is about obtaining the best trade-off given the constraints. So I could ask myself, which privacy-enhancing techniques are compatible with my use case? Homomorphic encryption could be ideal to process this data, but it won't scale to the quantity and throughput of data. Differential privacy, I cannot use because the data needs to be disaggregated. Then maybe local differential privacy could be an option, and so on. Once I choose a technique, what is the best parameter setting? To determine this, I need tools to measure and compare the privacy risk and the data quality in different settings.
That makes a lot of sense. Maybe we'll delve into tools later. So for now, I want to know how you deal with the fact that different jurisdictions around the world have different definitions and guidelines for anonymization. Stefano, tell us about Adhere Technologies.
Yeah, sure. Adhere, we keep a global privacy stance and adhere to all local regulations. This means that we always apply the strictest privacy rules from around the world. At times, we fall back to apply local regulations. This only happens, though, with products that are contractually limited to one jurisdiction, and we are confident it will not be exported to other jurisdictions in the future. We keep this strict policy because we want to avoid costly retrofitting of products to be compliant to different sets of requirements.
That makes sense to do. And Engin?
I want to mention a recent case in Europe that tests these different definitions of anonymization. So in this particular case, company A was sending data to a company B, and the data at company B was controlled in terms of re-identification. So the question was, is the data at company B anonymized? Because the source data remains at company A. There are different opinions. Some argue it's not, because there is always a risk to re-identify the persons, whereas others say it depends on the controls and how likely that this threat will occur. I think we don't have a clear threshold yet, so companies will have their own policies on what anonymization is. The assessment is done on a case-by-case basis. You also have specific regulations such as HIPAA, which has a method for de-identifying health data by removing identifiers. So as a result, similar to what Stefan has stated, I observed that organizations, they choose a global approach unless there's a specific rule from a jurisdiction. And that approach will depend on company's risk approach as well. So they will define their anonymization policy accordingly.
Yeah, you know, so much is risk-based when it comes to setting policy. So I imagine every company's got its own set of risk levers and risk tolerance that they need to consider. So that makes sense. What roadblocks do engineers run into when it comes to certain anonymization techniques like generalization, aggregation, density, noise addition, downsampling? Are those challenges? And then how did you overcome them to, you know, in order to achieve anonymization? Stefano, why don't we start with you?
Sure. From what I've seen, engineers typically get stuck when improving existing products. For example, apply a new anonymization technique to the product or adapting a product to a new requirement, such as management of data subject requests. A common example of those are rights to be forgotten type of requests with data deletion and so on. Products are bound by previous commitments with customers, which might be challenged by the proposed improvements. For example, changing the anonymization algorithm might reduce the quality of data below a certain target that has been agreed with the customer. Another example is data lineage. Implementing this functionality can enable automatic processing of data subject write requests, but it might also require a re-architecting of the product that can impact on response times or uptime targets. In these situations, we try two approaches. The technical approach requires working closely together with developers and product people to deeply understand the implementation and the commitments. This is a win-win situation, as privacy engineers learn real-world challenges, which effectively fuel privacy technology innovation. Once the product is well understood, anonymization parameters can be tuned appropriately. This might have the downside of reducing the privacy protection in other use cases, though. Then the business approach is to talk with our sales team and with the customers to discuss these commitments.
Oh, that's a really good point. Rarely do we ever think about circling back with the sales team and customers. That's a great point that we should think about more often, because that's kind of the initial point of contact with customers on data sharing. What about you, Engin?
I think in smaller companies, it's not so much on the techniques, but I still observe that the knowledge around anonymization is a bit immature. So I see that they just remove some PII and conclude that data is anonymized or deleted, which might or might not work depending on the jurisdiction you're operating in. I think for larger companies, there's definitely the challenge on getting those techniques implemented. The first one is on lack of proper tooling. So in large organizations, you might have custom database technologies that no one else is using outside your company, and data scattered across multiple teams. So getting a tool externally and getting it work with your tech stack is already challenging. And then asking every engineer to aggregate, mask, or generalize their own data manually is not scalable. So they need platforms to help them with that. So the lack of proper tooling is one challenge. Second is dependency within data sets. So a team might be okay with de-identifying or anonymizing their own data table, but there might be downstream services reusing this data. So this is called the problem of many hands. engineers might not even know why the data is even there at the first place. What is it doing there and what is it used for? So before even starting with anonymization, you need proper data classification and up-to-date data inventory so that to determine if it might be anonymized. And the last challenge I observe in large organizations is data sets with too many quasi-identifiers. If you can look, for example, the 2020 US Census, it has 9 questions, and there is also a U.S. Census American Community Survey, which has 20 questions. But in large companies, you might have tables with thousands of fields, and there might be hundreds of quasi-identifiers. So how would you apply a technique such as L-diversity in this case, or even considering this table will get updated continuously? So to summarize, we need tools to help engineers so that they can deploy anonymization techniques without so much hassle. And we also have to understand the limits of anonymization and determine if we need additional controls when it may not be feasible.
That's really interesting. Just like listening to both of you speak about your challenges, it's enlightening for me. So thank you for that. It's pretty exciting. What have you encountered on the business side in terms of business or policy challenges in getting anonymized data? Like, how do you get budgets and what are the challenges with scaling and regulatory requirements? How could you overcome them? And Jean, let's start with you first.
Yeah, I think going back to my example on this US Census Bureau. So the agency used differential privacy to apply on the census data, which, you know, improves the confidentiality of individual responses. But that led several researchers to protest, and they asked agency to abandon using differential privacy because it delayed the release of the data. So it took some time before it can be released to the public and to these agencies, and it wasn't accurate enough for their needs. This is definitely an issue in organizations as well, because, you know, once you say we have to anonymize the data, there will be some delay, and an expert will often need to be involved, which means extra costs. In other circumstances, like the government officials, they might require precise information. For example, the government of Egypt used to demand access to sensitive location data, and they did not want anonymized data. So these are some of the challenges, on not so much on technical limitations, but more on business and regulatory asks.
That makes sense. Stefano.
I encountered many of those challenges. I can tell about this. So HERE acquires data from thousands of sources, such as automotive manufacturers, commercial fleets, and so on. And the data flows between these entities. So it must comply with the anonymization criteria set by HERE, by the data providers, and by the regulatory bodies. So you can imagine that the standards typically do not look alike. They can differ a lot between entities. For this reason, HERE developed the anonymizer, a solution to measure the privacy risk of location data and anonymize it to align it with a predetermined level of privacy risk tolerance. This allows data providers to select their preferred anonymization level before sending their data to HERE.
That's great. Thank you for a peek inside your org. Now I'm going to ask you a question I ask quite a few people who come on the show. What does it mean to you in today's day and age to be a privacy engineer? Why don't we start with you, Engin?
Yeah, I think IAPP recently made an attempt to define privacy engineering. I think it's very interesting for a discussion. And they define a broad range of jobs that might fall under privacy engineering. So that, for example, would include software engineers building privacy tools, UX designers minimizing dark patterns, IT infra people like DevOps that could configure systems for better privacy, but even professionals handling physical architecture, like making privacy friendly choices in restrooms, patient rooms, etc. It's very broadly defined. So I think it depends on the organization, on how they define privacy engineering and what they want from those privacy engineers skills-wise. So at Uber, our privacy engineers focus on first privacy threat analysis in an engineering design architecture. We take a look and we ask questions and we recommend architectural changes and so that privacy by design is actually implemented. And the outcome would be technical controls like onboarding to a deletion platform or reducing unneeded data in request headers. We also do technical audits to reduce technical privacy debt. So these are controls that are missing in legacy systems. We support our engineers with ad hoc questions. How do you delete data from this particular database? We support our legal colleagues and give feedback on the policies. We also give specs and requirements to our software engineers in what to build and which new features do we need in existing tooling. So to summarize, we connect product and engineering to legal and other security teams and ensure that engineers get practical privacy advice. That might be very different in another organization. Maybe in another organization, privacy engineers are the software engineers building privacy tools. So you should understand what the organization wants from a privacy engineer and not just focus on the title. That's advice I can give.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, loyal listeners. The Shifting Privacy Left podcast is seeking sponsors who want to help educate our growing community of privacy engineers. Position your brand in front of privacy engineers, architects, developers, researchers, and privacy tech buyers. Insert a 30 to 60 second ad like this one into every published episode of the podcast. This is dynamic content, after all. Feature your new product, an upcoming conference, a sponsored special deal, endless opportunities. Email sponsorship@shiftingprivacyleft.com for more information on our sponsorship package. Okay, let's get back to our engaging privacy conversation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And if the episode that came out right before, that came out 2 weeks ago, that would be this past Tuesday, present day, but two episodes ago for anyone who's listening to this, with George Ratcliffe from Stott & May Recruiting, he really goes into kind of what companies are looking for based on their needs and from a perspective of a recruiter across multiple organizations. So I encourage folks to take a look at that episode as well. But Stefano, I would love to understand your perspective on privacy engineering and what it is to be a privacy engineer.
Yeah, I agree with what Engin said. So privacy engineering is an incredibly broad discipline. I like the description of privacy engineering specialties by Leah Kistner and Laurie Craner, which was published in their paper, Privacy Engineering Superheroes. Also, the title is pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
It resembles the PP classification. There are a few more roles beyond what Engin mentioned. So we have analysis consulting, privacy products, math and theory, privacy policy, incident and vulnerability response. So it's very broad. And each specialty has a unique skill set, but I think that all privacy engineers must have a broad knowledge of the product portfolio and also how competitors handle the same privacy issues in their similar products. In my day-to-day job, I am the point of contact for different stakeholders for a variety of privacy topics. This requires deep technical knowledge to compile data-driven reports that support stakeholder making an informed decision, business knowledge to understand the perspective of each stakeholder, as well as communication skills to clearly explain the trade-offs to the stakeholders. I also want to stress that the key here is to work with developers and product managers, as opposed to throwing them blockers and some impossible requirements from the top of our ivory tower.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thank you. So next, I want to understand how companies should think about data deletion capabilities, especially when it comes to integrating third-party tools. How can these tools be basically integrated into a company's architecture? And Gene, let's start with you.
I'm going to get a little bit technical, and I promise I'll keep it short. So the complexity arises when you have, again, large company with a distributed architecture. In distributed architectures, you have so-called microservices. So think of them as these small software blocks that do one thing very well, but they rely on others for functionality. So you kind of separate the business logic into different software blocks. So you might have a microservice for payments, another microservice for user signup, etc. And these microservices will have their own database and they will store their own data. So going back to your question, when you know we get an erasure request, a write erasure request from a user and it enters a company, typically a dispatcher service will take it and they will forward it to these different microservices and expect them to do their own deletion. There are different ways you can get this done. You can use an asynchronous model where you put messages in a queue and wait for the services to consume it, or you can do an API integration so that dispatcher's API endpoint will be implemented and these services will be listening to these incoming messages. Both approaches have pros and cons. When a third-party data sharing gets into play, it gets more complicated. So again, going back to my example on company selling t-shirts, let's assume the company uses another vendor for actual delivery of the t-shirts and assume that a microservice at company A is doing the integration and sending this data to company B. So who would actually send this erasure signal to the third party? You can have a centralized approach where one service handles all third-party integrations, or you can do different data owners integrating with different third parties. You should also think about auditing and logging of a request, because once data leaves your network, those external requests may be lost. Do we keep on retrying? How many times? What do we need to log? Do we need to log that the third party received the request? Did they execute the request, or did they just put it into their backlog? And maybe we don't use APIs because the third party doesn't have a support. Are we comfortable in sending CSV files? So as you can see, there are many engineering decisions to be made here. The legal requirements will just start a discussion, like forwarding requests to third party, but that's only the start of the engineering and the architecture process.
That's pretty enlightening. It just really shows you how much more complex the actioning upon the legal requirement is than the requirement itself. So curious if there's any attempts at standardizing requests, or is there an IEEE working group or something on third-party requests for data deletion, or is that a good opportunity for someone to create so that it kind of standardizes these as best practices across organizations?
I'm not aware of any work on this field, but as you said, this is definitely a good opportunity. I'm noticing many companies have, you know, using different approaches. They have different APIs, different requirements on APIs. So this is definitely an area where we will need more standardization.
Yeah, yeah. That would probably help with, I guess, decision-making and design. Okay. So, Stefano, what are some good career paths or skill sets for becoming a good privacy engineer? And where do you suggest people learn more?
Yeah, good question. As mentioned before, the field is very broad. So there's always the opportunity to study a particular subfield, for example, user experience, and then get involved into a privacy project later on. Once into the privacy space, I can suggest some general skills that then can help any privacy engineer. Risk management is the top one for me. It is very important to understand risk and talk risk, because a black and white privacy thinking doesn't really help. Then communication. Privacy engineer needs to communicate clearly to stakeholders with different backgrounds. Learning the basics of other backgrounds, for example, policy, business, and so on, helps a lot understanding the point of view of the stakeholders and communicating more convincingly. Then we have statistics. It helps estimating privacy risks and talking about those, which sort of grounds your reasoning. And then, of course, software architecture, very useful to give realistic improvement suggestions to product teams.
Thank you. That's super helpful. What about you, Enjin? What are some good career paths or skill sets for becoming a good privacy engineer? And where can people learn more?
So I think it depends on type of privacy engineer you want to be. But for our privacy engineers, we typically have two paths. The first one, which I want to call architecture to compliance, is, you know, we have folks with extensive experience in building software systems, and they typically gain more on the privacy compliance side. So I sometimes hear from other privacy professionals that compliance knowledge is not necessary or should not be the main focus, because we should go beyond compliance anyway. But if you do not grasp concepts such as secondary use, pseudonymization, lawful basis, you know, your understanding of privacy threats will be limited. I met software engineers building privacy tools thinking you always need user consent or consent is sufficient to satisfy user privacy. So the second part is, which I call the compliance to architecture part, is when you have a seasoned privacy pro learning more on the software components or systems. You don't need to actually code, but you need to speak the same language as the engineers. And the advice you give is granular and actionable. This means that it's not just doing a PIA with a software engineer and communicating policy requirements like delete data according to policy, but actually understand technical limitations, capabilities, and maybe opportunities. You know, when you see common patterns of issues across different products, you should be able to recommend different technical solutions that will be more efficient for different teams. How do you gather those skills? Maybe join engineering discussions as a privacy SME and learn more about these software components, or you build software yourself to understand how these systems work in harmony. The second part is more difficult because there is a lot of, you know, learning curve. Many privacy pros have given up due to this learning curve, but the first part, it does not deliver many privacy engineers. Often software engineers don't want to narrow down their scope. They want to, you know, have a larger scope in software engineering. And typically only those that are really passionate about privacy stick around.
That's really fascinating insight. Thank you for that. That really is, because every company kind of has its own way of doing things. And it's nice to know that there is an opportunity for privacy pros that want to get more technical, like applied technical and work with engineering teams that aren't necessarily coders. But it's also fascinating to understand maybe why it's harder to get privacy engineers pumped out, you know, if they're not coming out of like a Carnegie Mellon privacy engineering school with like a master's and a PhD in the topic, like where do you go find them, right? And why is it so hard to find them? I think you kind of gave some good perspective on why they might not be drawn to a hyper-focused engineering path like privacy engineering. I mean, but I'm with you. I think it's freaking fascinating, obviously. And I can't get enough of talking about privacy and data protection. So I'm definitely in that second bucket. Let's broaden the discussion a little bit to something that's so hot right now, right? AI, especially for like generative AI and, you know, LLMs, large language models. What should privacy engineers understand about vendor privacy requirements for like LLMs if they're bringing that into an organization? Let's start with you, Stefano.
I think even before starting evaluating vendors, privacy engineers should verify under what circumstances or preconditions they can apply artificial intelligence to their use case. Some AI-related regulations and guidelines to review are the EU AI Act and the Ethics Guidelines for Trustworthy AI. Once you verify that, then you can think about which vendors you want to choose. An approach that I take when evaluating vendors is to put myself in the shoes of their privacy engineers. I collect as much information as possible about their business model and product design, then think about how I would build privacy into their product. Given these constraints, could a privacy engineer justify to their management adding privacy-enhancing technologies and minimizing data collection, or does it have too big of an impact on their business needs? Another complementary approach is to ask the vendor to invite a privacy engineer to the product demonstration and evaluation meeting. That is a quick way to get a better understanding of the privacy stance of that product, and also helps your fellow privacy engineer proving to their management that privacy is an important feature of their product offering.
I like that approach. I think that makes a lot of sense. What about you, Engin?
I think this is an interesting field that is moving very fast. I observe companies going with different paths. Some of them are using open source on-prem models, which reduces the risk of data breaches, but it requires quite a hefty investment in computing and personal resources. Also, I'm hearing the performance might not always be optimal. Commercial models provide much better performance, and there are no upfront costs, but there are questions around their security posture. So As a company, I think before using an LLM vendor, the first question you should ask, do you really need LLM or generative AI capabilities for your purpose? Maybe you can use a traditional machine learning for your use case. Maybe you want to be able to explain the decisions in detail. So the first step is to understand, will you really benefit from these LLMs and does it worth the risk? Second, after deciding whether to use an on-prem or a commercial offering, you need to do diligence, thinking about security, environment, and of the vendor, but also, is the vendor storing your input and output for follow-up analysis? Are they using such data to retrain their own models? There are serious concerns around hallucinations. For example, the model creating syntactically and semantically accurate output, but it's not factual. What about bias in data set of the vendors? It kind of depends on what type of project you have. If you do a general market analysis, maybe you can tolerate some inaccuracy. But if you're trying to automate hiring and sourcing, for example, you feed in a job description and LLM helps you finding the right candidates, you have much higher risk. And other things to consider is data deletion. If your data is used by the vendor, how will they delete the data? And deleting data from training data set, is it sufficient for the model to forget that particular user's data? There are all these considerations and many more you have to make, and you always have to be transparent to your end users if you decide to use one of those LLMs in your product offering. So probably, you know, you have a risk governance framework already in order, but you might need to update it based on these new threats.
Yeah. And then with all those questions, it'll be interesting to see what like regulatory bodies like the FTC and others in the EU, what kind of potential fines and, you know, requirements they'll place on an organization. If they want you to delete the data set, they might actually not just make you delete the training data, but delete the model it was trained on. In the US, we call that disgorgement. It'll be interesting to see what the FTC, what their stance is on companies that they feel unethically train their data with maybe personal data or other risks. So we'll stay tuned.
To add, I think FTC has this interesting report on OpenAI. I, you know, recommend all the listeners to read. You can understand what they are expecting from a generative AI offering. It offers an interesting risk framework, and that will be valuable to understand the expectations.
Great. I'll look that up and I'll try to put that in the show notes for other people to access. Okay. So what other trends are you seeing in the world of privacy engineering? Stefano?
My impression is that the industry is slowly reaching a more mature state where tools to anonymize risky data are available and easy to use. Now, the focus of the privacy engineer is shifting from product-specific controls towards company-level controls, which govern privacy risks across products and data types. For example, HR data, product data, and so on. Examples of privacy governance solutions are data and product catalogs, which collect privacy-related labels and information on how data is processed in the company. The most advanced solutions are able to dynamically update this information by monitoring changes in the data or in the source code. I also see this shift in the privacy vendors, with the market moving from early solutions focused on providing anonymization algorithms for specific products or use cases towards company-wide governance of privacy risks. One example is Privado, which we use at HERE to monitor the compliance of our products and data lineage.
Awesome. Privado is also the sponsor of our show, and I sit on their advisory board, so I'm a big fan. And Gene, I think you also have a relationship with Privado that we want to disclose. So, and why don't you answer also the question, what trends are you seeing in the world of privacy engineering?
Yeah, I also provide consulting service to Privado. I think, Privado provides or is working on practical privacy solutions. I think vendors should listen to privacy practitioners to better understand what the industry needs. I notice some tool offerings, but that's a problem we had a couple of years ago. We already have in-house deployments, and there are other areas where we really need a vendor to step in, but that's not addressed. So typically some vendors see it as an undesired cost, but, you know, building something that doesn't provide much added value for practitioners will lead costly redesign. So I'd recommend, you know, let's build solutions that fix our biggest problems first.
And so just so that we explain to people why we're even mentioning Privado, what is it about that? What, if you could just describe their tool and how that helps you with things like anonymization or location data, or, you know, how do you use it, and why are you bringing it up?
We don't use Privado at Uber, but based on what I've seen on the tool, it can detect new assets being added to the inventory, new API endpoint being added. It also does code scanning. So some privacy threats in code can be identified and managed. What they're also working on long term is something health with the design reviews and understanding privacy risk that might come out early on, and then tie it back to the code parts where you can actually validate some of the requirements you set during the design review. I think that's a very, very useful. Many companies do design reviews or PIAs, but that ends up as some tickets in a specific tool, and validation becomes more difficult. Tying the code analysis back to original design requirements will be very, very useful.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and really key to DevPrivOps as privacy is being added to the DevOps process. Awesome. Okay, so moving on, how do you guys deal with conflicts between engineering, legal, and operations teams? I know that you are very much interfaces between all of them. So yeah, what's your approach to dealing with conflicts? Let's start with you, Engin.
I think when a conflict arises, typically it's because accountability is not very well defined. I'll give an example. In the early days of GDPR, I've seen an organization where the legal team owned privacy, but they do not want to define operational or technical requirements for engineers, because they didn't feel like they had the right expertise. But that those legal requirements did not work for the engineering teams, because they needed something much more tangible and actionable, but they lacked the knowledge of privacy laws and regulations, so they couldn't themselves create those requirements. And things changed after they hired their first privacy architect, and I won't tell who this person is, you can make your guess. In an ideal setting, I think the legal team defines policies, works with the risk, accepted risk, and informs the rest of the company on new developments. Privacy engineers and more operational folks will help translate those requirements, but also give feedback back to the legal team so that we update policies based on technical capabilities, but we also build new tools and features based on policy changes. So again, define accountability properly and the teams, I think, will work in harmony.
That's great. Great perspective. What about you, Stefano?
I think conflicts arise because of each of these teams brings a different perspective to the table. For example, legal teams tend to have a better understanding about compliance risks than product teams, while product teams tend to have a better understanding of business requirements. And the role of the privacy engineer is to evaluate these perspectives in an objective and data-driven way, then guide the stakeholders to reaching an agreement. Of great help for successfully dealing with conflicts, I find a strong privacy culture in the company. Unlike revenue and efficiency and others, privacy is not necessarily recognized or like a broadly recognized value. And so stakeholders are not necessarily ready to compromise for it. And from my experience, the most efficient way to build a privacy culture is to educate upper management and have them advocating for privacy in their teams. And you know who's responsible for educating upper management is the privacy engineer.
Yeah, so it's a lot of responsibility besides just engineering. I know a lot of responsibility falls on privacy engineers to kind of get stuff done even at a higher level.
Yeah, you never get bored.
Never get bored. Yeah. Okay, so what's the best way to get privacy issues fixed in an organization? Engin?
I think biggest challenge in getting privacy issues fixed is not on technical disagreements or choosing the most efficient solution. It's more about scaling. In large organizations, privacy engineers cannot fix everything or even have the bandwidth to track all privacy issues across the board. The first thing to do would be identifying key engineering leaders, those who have authority, and get them nominate some privacy champions to get those issues fixed. So typically, privacy champions will be senior engineers. They know the specific of their product's architecture. They know who covers what, who owns which technical feature, and they will also have some authority to get some resources to get things fixed. They will also send you a signal if they discover privacy vulnerabilities at the system level. So after securing resources and getting some champions, you should talk with this team, train them, and together identify a plan to address high-risk issues, dependencies, and then have some estimated time to fix these issues. You won't be able to fix everything immediately. So think of privacy debt. Another thing to consider is being transparent in efforts to hire up. Show them what is pending, what is fixed, and what are the blockers. And later, use these learnings and then train your engineers better so they actually address these issues early in design. So it doesn't, so that you don't have to do this all the time. So focus on privacy by design, not on privacy by remediation. This will be a continuous exercise.
That's really, really great advice. Stefano, what is your perspective?
Yeah, it's very aligned. I really like the privacy champions approach. And I want to add that it doesn't have to be only engineers. It can also be product managers and other kind of figures. I say this because privacy issues are ideally resolved proactively even before they surface. So even at the product development, before development starts. So privacy engineers need to be involved in product design from the start while there is still room to adjust the product architecture and before the requirements are finalized. So in this context, the most effective approach is to addressing privacy concerns is to establish a comprehensive privacy engineering program and shift privacy left. So as Engin said, privacy by design.
And we all know that I'm for shifting privacy left, naming my show exactly that. So we are definitely aligned. Okay, before we close, do you guys have any last words of wisdom for the audience as we close the conversation, starting with you, Stefano?
Yeah, I have a message for my fellow privacy engineers. Do not overlook the less technical aspects of the work as they constitute the foundation of privacy by design. Your objective should be to establish a robust privacy process deeply integrated into the product and development lifecycle. You need to collaborate closely with product and engineering teams, obtain the support through privacy education, and incorporate their feedback into the process. This approach ensures that the process aligns with these teams rather than working against them. A strong privacy by design process also enables the early detection and mitigation of privacy concerns, starting from the conceptualization and design of the product. This facilitates the seamless integration of privacy-enhancing technologies into the product later on when development starts. Yeah, moreover, product and engineering teams can actively become participants in the privacy by design process by identifying and reporting privacy issues themselves.
Great advice. Great advice. Engin, what's your great advice?
I think it's simple. You should really have some passion for privacy in order to sustain in this field. So the field itself is not 100% mature, such as security, and it is ambiguous. There's often no one right solution. People often ask me, how do I become a privacy engineer? I just got my CIPT or my master's in cybersecurity. There are different paths, as we discussed, but again, the passion will help because there will be a lot of things to consume. There are new articles being published on AI Act, generative AI architecture, such as transformer models, homomorphic encryption, generative AI governance. You need to keep up to date with this material. That means you'll have to do a lot of reading, and to do such reading, you really need to love this field. I know people who've been here over a decade, and they still ping me at night with a new article published on privacy stress. You need to have this passion. I've seen some folks who entered the field because it was a hot topic. There was a lot of hiring, but they left in a couple of years because learning just got too tiring for those folks. So that learning should not be a burden for you. It should be excitement. If you like it, you should carry on. If you don't, you have to have a, you know, reflect on what you want to do. Maybe you want to stay in the privacy domain, but not as a privacy engineer. Maybe you want to do something else. But passion and love for privacy is the key.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, I obviously have the passion But I think we're constantly drinking from a fire hose, even though privacy engineers might love their work. I do want to say that it can be exhausting to continue to drink from ever-changing fire hose of news and, you know, changing requirements and case law and just having to put it all together. I hear what you're saying. There, I also get a lot of satisfaction out of putting all those pieces together and then almost trying to solve as if it's a puzzle on how do you get to the right outcome for an organization based on its business needs and then the needs of effective privacy and putting those controls in place. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I do think that people can get really burnt out if they don't want to continue to constantly learn new things. This was really, really a great conversation. I think that my first interview having two guests has been a success. So thank you for being my guinea pigs. I think this episode's going to be really well received because it's a lot of meaty from the front lines of being a privacy architect and a privacy engineer in actual job roles and not just talking about privacy engineering abstractly. You know, I just want to thank you so much for joining us today on Shifting Privacy Left.
Thank you, Deborah. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Deborah.
Excellent. Okay. Until next Tuesday, everyone, when we'll be back with engaging content and another great guest or guests.
Thanks for joining us this week on Shifting Privacy Left. Make sure to visit our website, shiftingprivacyleft.com, where you can subscribe to updates so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found this episode valuable, go ahead and share it with a friend. And if you're an engineer who cares passionately about privacy, check out Privato, the developer-friendly privacy platform and sponsor of this show. To learn more, go to privato.ai. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday for a new episode. Bye for now.